Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
This is something that's been talked about for a while here in the city, off and on. It comes up, it's discussed sometimes, it goes away, but it's back seemingly on a burner. I don't know if it's the front burner or the back burner, but free transit is being discussed again. There are groups that are pushing for this. There is discussion about whether it's a good idea, and especially in a city that has more poverty than other cities do. Should we be having free transit in the city of Hamilton? As I say, there are a number of groups that have proposed this. One city councillor who has raised the question, I'll let her answer whether she is asking because she's wanting this or simply curious about this. Tammy Wang, new Ward 4 councillor. I think that's her first time on the show today. Councillor, thanks for doing this today.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
So let me ask that. I don't know, truthfully, if this is a question, because you raised the question during a budget meeting, I believe, asking the head of transit about this idea. I don't know whether this is something you want to see happen or whether you were simply inquiring to see if it was feasible. Where do you fall on this?
I was inquiring whether it was feasible. At the end of the day, when we're talking about budget, it was around what is the actual number? Because how do you make a decision when you don't have all the information? So at the time, Director Cousin Heath said that it was approximately 42 to 43 million to a year for us to make it free.
And that would be free for, like, that's free for everybody. That's, you can just walk up and get on a bus.
Exactly. Like Luxembourg, like Brussels, like any of those European cities that have been piloting it and actually making the jump city, like countrywide, to free transit.
Now, okay, so you raised the question to ask about whether it was feasible. Do you think that it's a good idea in Hamilton?
I think definitely it makes sense to offer free transit because it's about an equity issue. It's about ensuring that our most marginalized, our most vulnerable population is able to get free, frequent, convenient transit to actually get them from point A to point B. And it's thinking about how are we building a better society and a better city for our future generations. And that also talks about all of the wonderful things from climate change. And it also talks about just general wealth creation and thinking about it from that opportunity of getting to work on time or being able to live where you can afford it and being able to still get to where you need to go.
We do, and we have had some free transit, right? Up until this point, there are some people who still who do qualify to ride for free. Am I correct?
Yes. So we have currently, there is anybody that's under the age of 5 rides for free. Right now, we do have a program 6 to 12 students. They can ride for free. We have the Golden Pass, which is 80 years old and up. We have subsidized passes for those that are mobility or accessibility or disabled passengers. So there is a variety of different ways that we are actually providing subsidized service.
And so I think some people would say, okay, well, if that's the case, why broaden it to everybody, including those who could afford to do it without subsidies or without a free pass?
I think that at the end of the day, it's about equity across the board. Because when we are thinking about how we are building a, and this is directly from the vision of the city of Hamilton, how are we becoming the best place to raise a child and age successfully? It's around ensuring that we're being fiscally minded. We're actually building a better community with we're being much more green and environmental. There's an equity issue allowing everyone to access transit. But I'll also tell you, I am a child of immigrants and my family coming from China, which is one of the most populous countries in the entire world, and public transit is a necessity and a base and a very essential, essentially a utility. They come to Canada saying that this is a first world country, but yet we are forcing people to buy cars that they can't afford. We're forcing people to get on to essentially remove some of the, we're actually also forcing people to turn down jobs because they cannot get there. And then I also think about how we speak about economic development. How are we attracting the workforce of the future if we're not enabling a transit system that allows them to get from where they live to where they work?
And I think certainly there are going to be people who would be nodding their heads and agreeing with that. I also think that, and you mentioned it a few minutes ago, that the head of transit said that the amount would be about $42 million a year. I've also heard a report of $47 million, something in there. That's going to be like 4.5% minimum of an increase on property taxes. I think there's an awful lot of people, too, who are saying, wait a second, I would love this, but we're already paying a lot of taxes, and I don't know that we can continue to just keep piling these things on our taxes and attract people to the city.
Absolutely. And that's why I wanted to ask the question, because frankly, if we don't know how much it actually costs us, how do we actually get there? So this was one of those areas where maybe it's not tacking on to what we have currently, but maybe it's taking a really hard look at all of the programs and the services that we offer, which ones are redundant, which ones are inefficient, which ones could be shored up, and then taking it, because we know that taxpayers, that well of money is not infinite. We also know that you don't just generate money out of nowhere. So this is why we need to think about what are all of the costs, what are the different inputs, what are the service levels that we're really looking at, and how do we rejig all of them to make it all work? Now, that's mindful that maybe we are treating free transit as a council priority, and that's something that we aspire to do in the next couple of years. But this council is not going to willy-nilly tax and spend and put more hardship on the taxpayers.
It is, I think you're right with something you just said there, which is I think this is going to be on the table and being discussed. I don't think this is something that we're not going to be hearing about. I think this is certainly going to be something that council is going to be talking about and we're going to be hearing debates about over the next number of years. And I appreciate you coming on and talking about it today to sort of set the table. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you so much, Scott.
That is Councillor Tammy Wang, Ward 4 new councillor. You know, one of the things that she just said there, whether you like the idea of free transit or not, and I don't mean, I mean, sure, everyone would like free transit. Why wouldn't we want free transit? But it's not really free, and she alluded to this. There is cost, 42, 47, whatever it is, million dollars. But what she said that I think a lot of people probably, hopefully heard, and boy, this would be great if other councillors, if the council heard what Councillor Wang just said here, if I heard her correctly, which was, let's look at everything with a really close magnifying glass. And if we're going to find, we can't tax everything, we can't add everything. If we're going to say free transit is a priority and we have to find $46 million, $47 million, $42 million, what can we cut to find that money? See, that suddenly makes something like this, I think, for even people who might not be transit riders, that might make it seem almost palatable if it's not just added on to the levy. If council, whether Councillor Wang or just other ones, if council simply says, you know what, we're going to start with 4.5% of an increase and build from there. And, you know, who cares? We're just going to add that to it. I think people are going to blanch. And in fact, I think there are a whole bunch of counselors that would say no to that. But if they can say, hey, this is going to be a net zero, we're going to add this by taking other stuff away. Suddenly it's not nearly, I don't think, as antagonizing to people who have to pay property taxes. That's an interesting position.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
I want to talk about it's a wild story and not in a good way. This is maybe shocking is a better word. I don't know. Pick whatever adjective you want here. But there's a new report out that says that 40% of Canadian farmers, will retire over the next decade, leaving us with a shortage. 40%. Of farmers in 10 years, by 2033, 40% of our farmers are going to be hanging up their plow or just retiring. I don't know if you can hang it up, but putting it away. It is not a laughable matter. I mean, it is deadly serious because as our country is expanding, don't forget, we had 1 million new people come to this country last year. We are growing very quickly. 40% of our farmers are saying they're not going to be doing it anymore. What do we do with this kind of information? Keith Curry is the president of the Canadian Federation of Agriculture. He himself is a farmer. Joins us now. Keith, thanks for doing this today.
Happy to be here, and especially when you have a lead-in with Paul McCartney and Junior's Farm. I mean, it's right up my alley. So
there you go. This, as I say, when I saw this story, I had to read it twice because, I mean, I can understand 10% of farmers saying they're going to retire or of any, you know, profession, or 20% maybe even. But we're getting close to half of the farmers in this country saying they're ready to throw in the towel on this. And I don't know where we go when that happens.
Well, I think you have to look at it in the bigger perspective of general society. And, you know, we have a lot of baby boomers in general that are retiring throughout all aspects of society. So farming's no different. And, you know, the reality is most of us retire off the farm when the pine box shows up down the laneway. But, you know, it is concerning that, you know, we have a lot of our farmers that are reaching the age of retirement and wanting to retire. And we have to make sure that we have not only the proper succession planning in place, but we have that labor aspect of things that are going to be there available, at least for the next generation of farmers to carry on those operations.
All right. So, yes, it is true that people retire in every profession, but if a computer programmer retires, there's always someone lining up to take their spot. If I step away, there's someone who's going to take this radio show. I don't see, and maybe I'm just not seeing it, but I don't see tons and tons and tons of young people coming out of high school saying, I want to buy a farm and be a farmer.
So what I will say is, yes, we saw the RBC report, and really there's not a lot of shock value there for us because we knew what was probably going to come out of that report. But, you know, a whole bunch of years ago when I made the decision to take over my, at that time, seventh generation farm, I kept hearing about, you know, mid-50s was the average age of the farm and we're in trouble. But the reality is the when you look at farming across Canada, 97-98% of our farms are family owned and operated. So we're also looking at different levels of ownership as well. So you have not only the parents, but you have sons and daughters, and you have grandmas and grandpas. And now we're expanding because the operations are larger into cousins and aunts and uncles, etc. So we'll have to see how that all plays out going down the road. But, I mean, we're in a labor struggle right now. So it's only going to get exacerbated if you know, even a large part of that 40% retires. So we need to figure out how to move forward.
And I would say, and again, I mean, you're saying what I think a lot of people would believe about the farming community, and that is, you know, you say seventh generation. I think a lot of people think dad farm, granddad farm, so I'm going to become a farmer. But this same report says 66% of farmers, of producers, don't have a succession plan in place. I'm reading that to potentially say this generation that's coming along not necessarily wanting to stick around and take over the farm.
Yes, that's a very staggering number. But if I can put it into a little bit of perspective from when I started, I would say 5% at best of farmers had any kind of succession planning in place. And I'm a prime example where I was married 3 months, planning to come into my farming operation. My father had a brain aneurysm, and all of a sudden, the game's changed. Mm. And I think we have learned a lot, especially in the last decade, 15 years, about the need to have our ducks lined up, so to speak, when it comes to the succession aspect. Do we need to be better? Absolutely, we do need to be better. But at least the conversations are happening now, and hopefully this leads, you know, the fact that we're going to have a shortage of people coming into the farming operations, it leads to those better succession planning conversations amongst families going forward.
How does someone get into farming these days? Is it almost always within the family, or are there people who are coming out of high school and saying, I've never been around a farm, but I want to be a farmer?
Well, as I said earlier, like we're looking at roughly around 97% of the farms
still
in Canada and really North America that are family owned and operated. So ideally as a farmer, I want my children to have the most opportunity to take over the farm. But when you look at our operations, we do have a lot of outside labor on the farm, and just take horticulture, for example. And then, you know, certainly if you look south of Hamilton and the Niagara region, There's a big tender fruit area. There's a big vegetable area where we bring in a lot of seasonal ag workers, and many of them have been coming here for decades, sometimes two, maybe even three generations. And some of those workers have become managers on the farm. So maybe there's an opportunity, if they want to buy into the farming operation. So we have to look at those kinds of aspects for people to get started. It's a very expensive business to get into.
I was just going to ask you that, because I don't know what the average farm, what the average size would be. How much land do you need for an average farm?
Well, it would depend on the type of farming that you're in. If you look at the Holland Marsh, which is Ontario's salad bowl, for example, you know, there are still some plots there that are 5 and 10 hectares, or, you know, maybe 10 acres, 10 to 20 acres, where you have a high-value crop, intensive crop. So you can potentially make a living out of that small of an acreage, but by and large, you're looking at, you know, 1,500, 2,000 acres, 3,000 acres is kind of getting close to be the normal size farm these days. So, you know, just the land purchase alone, especially if you look in the greater Toronto area, it's almost impossible unless you have some help. So, you know, a lot of farms today are incorporated. So that gives you some additional tools as far as, you know, passing on shares gradually and this type of thing into creating opportunities for succession, and certainly working with the federal government on some Income Tax Act changes where maybe capital gains can be shared between generations so that it isn't as large are certainly options that are on the table.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think you were bang on when you said a moment ago that, you know, we have some great people that come from out of the country to help work on farms, and heaven knows, I mean, we'd be in rough shape if suddenly all these people were not working on these farms. They've done amazing work. I just don't know how many of them would be in a position to round up enough money to buy a 1,000-acre farm. I mean, it's an extraordinary amount of money you would need to do that. And so you've got these people that could do it. They're just facing a hurdle to be able to do it.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. But it's no different than anyone outside of agriculture and general society trying to buy a house these days and how difficult that is. So it becomes, again, part of that succession planning story, that conversation. How do we make sure that we ensure that our prime ag land continues to produce food for Canadians and people around the world? You know, as a farmer selling their property, or if there's no one in their own family taking over, you want to capitalize as much as you can on what the value of that land is. But if you want that property to stay in agriculture, you're going to figure out how to arrange that succession plan so that you get what you need, but it doesn't overburden the person coming into the operation so much that they can't succeed. So those are the conversations that have to happen, you know, continually going forward and evolving because of the finances involved. It's a very complex conversation.
Are those things happening? So we only have a minute or so here. So the idea that we want people now to take over these farms, whether it's children of farmers or other people who are taking them over, it is very expensive to start up or to do that. Is Ottawa or Ontario doing anything right now to make it more palatable, to make it easier for people who want to get into this business?
Well, certainly, I know general farm organizations, provincial general farm organizations like the Ontario Federation of Agriculture are doing extensive education platforms for their members to make them understand that you need to have a plan. And I really think people now are talking more than they ever did about what's going to happen. And part of that is even through estate planning. Because when you go to your lawyer to drop a will, they're going to say, well, what's going to happen to the farm? So that's part of the process that we really didn't talk about a lot in the past. You know, talking to both provincial and federal governments around the tax implications of succession planning is really important. And how do we give young people a break on interest rates, for example, to maybe get engaged in the act of buying out an operation is certainly conversations we're having on an ongoing basis. So the talks are happening. We just have to somehow get it to a place where it's tangible.
Yeah, well, if we like to eat, and I think most of us do, we're going to want to try and figure something out to keep people farming in this country. Keith Curry, the president of the Canadian Federation of Agriculture, thanks for the time today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate being on.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Today, even though it's Tuesday, we're playing it like it's a Monday because yesterday we were enjoying a day off for the end of Easter weekend. Normally on Mondays, Don Robertson is in, owner and operator of the Dundas Real McCoys and Calm Choice Realty and the leading contender for the 2023 Dundas Citizen of the Year. And very soon to be the host of the Allen Cup in Dundas at the J.L. Grantmeyer Arena that starts next Monday. We'll be talking about that later in the show. But Don Robertson here this evening. Thanks for doing this.
You're welcome, Scott. It's nice to be here.
So we don't have the Leaf game on the TV in the studio right now. Last week, we talked about the Leafs goaltending scenario and the fact that they could have put Curtis Joseph in net at 52 or was it 56 years old, whatever he was.
Wasn't 56.
So 54, I don't know. He's in his 50s. They had a chance to do that because of their emergency backup. Well, now, because of the Leafs salary cap scenario, where they are so tight to the salary cap, they can't afford to call guys up. And they don't want to play their starting goalie tonight against Tampa because they're going to play Tampa in the first round of the playoffs. They don't really have another goalie. So if Tampa had any brains whatsoever, they would run Toronto's goalie and knock him out before they get to the playoffs, and then Toronto's completely snookered. So they're not going to put him in net. So Toronto has, it looks like, and I don't have the TV on right now, but it looks like they were trying to get an exemption to call up their AHL goalie. And they've also signed a guy to an amateur tryout who may go in and may end up playing tonight. So we're back to goalies, but here's what I was thinking today about this. If you were that amateur tryout goalie, you're a 21-year-old, 22-year-old university hockey goalie from Canada who is nowhere near the NHL, and you could go in and you're playing Tampa, and there's a chance you could give up 8 or 9 goals and it could be a rough night for you. Would you trade that? Would you do that for the one chance in your life to play an NHL game?
You mean, would you go in knowing you're going to get hammered?
If you knew that you might get shelled.
Every goaler in the planet that's never played in the NHL would do that.
I think you're right.
Scott Radley would do that.
Oh, I would do it 100%.
Yeah.
It would be humiliating. I mean, for me, it would be humiliating. Presumably, this guy's a little better than I am. But, I mean, you would hope.
If he's got his own gear, he likely is.
Yeah, you would hope. But, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think people would absolutely, regardless of whatever humiliation they think they might face, would take that chance.
Well, I think in the past there's been Olympic athletes put things in their bodies for a chance to win a gold medal, not yes. even being sure they could do it. And knowing they may not have a long life. Look at some wrestlers.
Yeah.
Some of the things they do to themselves doesn't really promote living to be 100. But you're right. It's a great opportunity. I'm glad they didn't call Mike Mole.
you might need him in a week.
We are going to need him in a week. And, you know, so it's – I mean, I thought it was great. Now, Cujo didn't dress so, did he? He was the back emergency goalie in the stands. Yeah. This kid was – and I was actually watching the game because – it makes me feel better from when the Montreal Canadiens used to hammer the Toronto Maple Leafs through the 70s. They didn't beat them the odd game. They beat them for a decade. And so I was kind of pleased when I saw him doing it. Of course, I hearken back to our conversation here the Monday previous on what do you do and is it a good move with Cujo? And this kid has stories for a lifetime.
Yeah. Now, I don't know. We just turned this on, so someone may already be watching and may know the answer. I don't know who's in net today. I don't know if the kid is backing up. Nonetheless, I just thought it was a question that if they came, whether it was the Leafs to play net or whether it was, I mean, take it, pick whoever you want. Pick whatever sport you want. If they said, would you like to go in and play quarterback for the Ticats for a quarter or a half? Because we don't want to get our guy hurt. We just need someone to come in. I think that almost everybody would say, yeah, sure, I'll do that. And would even take the risk in that case of just getting blasted.
Ending up in a hospital for 6 months.
You know, you could.
That's a little goalies, right?
You could. You could. I mean, you know, if you're playing quarterback and you don't know what you're doing, you could end up being smushed. I mean, someone once said to me, they asked the question, it was a terrific question. They said, at Mike Tyson's peak, if they said, would you go in the ring to fight Mike Tyson for $1 million? And my initial answer was, well, yeah, I would go in and I would just cover my head. And the first time he hit me, I'd fall down and that would be the end of it to make sure I survived. I'm not sure, though, that even if I covered my head, his shot to my ribs wouldn't kill me.
Yeah, I'm not sure that would have been a good decision, unless they would let you fall down when the bell rang.
Yeah, that's right. Oops, I tripped and sprained my ankle. Or just sprint around the ring so he can't catch you. Now, my initial thought was, sure, I would do that for $1 million. But I realized there are some things that I wouldn't get into a UFC cage because I don't know what I'm doing. I'd be seriously hurt. I wouldn't get into a boxing ring with Mike Tyson, but to play goal in the NHL for a turn, to play a quarter in the NBA, even though you know that you are going to be the laughing stock of your friends forever because you're going to be so bad, I would still do it.
Well, this kid, did he make a save? Because I stopped watching.
I don't even know. I don't know if he's in right now.
No, the other night.
Oh, no, he didn't get a shot.
Yeah, I didn't.
He didn't get a shot. And somehow, okay, let me ask you about that one, because there was a player for the Canadians after who was totally sour that the Leafs had put this kid in for a minute.
I heard that.
And it was 7-1. The Leafs had outshot them. I think the shot clock had like overheated and started smoking and sparking. They had so many shots. The people in the press box had to pull an abacus out to keep track because all the computers had broken. And they said, let's put the guy in to give him a thrill. What in the world is wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with it. And the Montreal Canadian players' disgust and disappointment was misguided. He should have taken a look in his own dressing room. I mean, trying to deflect blame and create a different story or a different narrative after the game, you thought that was disgusting that they did that to you? I mean, everybody should go take a little peek in the mirror. It was a poor performance, and switching the narrative made you look like, well, you're trying to switch the narrative.
Yeah, I mean, if the Canadians had had a backup goalie who was a university player that night when they were down 7-1, I would have hoped they would have put him in to give him a one-minute taste of the NHL, and then you would have said, yeah, well, that's good for him. You know, whether he gets shots or whether he gives up a goal, good for him.
So the fact that they're in this...
It's like fantasy camp.
The fact they're in this dilemma probably speaks to another conversation about management.
Oh, see, I think this is brilliant management.
Is it that you have to sign a college student to an amateur tryout or pro tryout?
I think it's brilliant.
Stay within that salary cap?
Yeah, and play a man short today. I think it's brilliant only because they've already clinched a playoff spot. They've already clinched home ice. They can't affect their standings in any way. And they have used up essentially every nickel of the salary cap. Like they've done it so precisely that you can't, it's so tight you couldn't even have a guy come up for one game. I think that's manipulating the salary cap as best you possibly can.
Well, I would agree if they could dress a full lineup tonight, but they can't.
They don't need to. They don't. That's the point. It's a meaningless game.
But if you were doing the perfect job, you would always have a full lineup and not be short a guy.
Okay. That's true. Fair enough. I just think in this – now, had
– Yeah, I get what you're saying.
Had this been a game – let's say tonight against Tampa Bay, they had to win this game to get home ice.
Or get in the playoffs.
It would have been a disastrous job of managing the salary cap. It would have been a complete catastrophe. But the reality is that they have been locked into a playoff spot since about November.
Yeah.
And they've had home ice basically – well, I mean, they just locked it up recently, but they've been in that position for weeks.
They locked it up Saturday night or Sunday night by losing. They lost to Boston, right? When they lost to Boston, they locked up a playoff spot because Tampa – or home ice because Tampa lost.
Yeah. But they were far enough ahead.
They deserve to be in second place.
If you are in that position, well, it's always one of those things that if it works out, you were brilliant. If it doesn't work out, you were an idiot. it worked out for them, so they get the credit for, you know, next year it could be a disaster. Next year it could be a complete, it could completely blow up in your face if you try to pull this again.
Yeah.
But, you know,
for it now, hasn't, well, it hasn't. We haven't seen what's going on yet, but.
Yeah, we haven't. We'll see. We'll see if the Leafs get, if we'll see if that kid who they just signed to the ATO has to go in and he gives up 9 goals today and goes home with a Maple Leaf sweater and a story to tell his kids, but a little humiliation. But
sunburn on his back neck.
It could be. Could be. Are you a romantic about opening day in baseball and home opener in baseball and all those things like so many people seem to be?
No. What? I think they're cool.
Mm.
But the truth is, it's just another baseball game. I mean, it's interesting that the official start of spring in my world is the Masters, and generally opening day for the Blue Jays. So they kind of coincide within 72 hours. So, and it was 70 degrees out today, or whatever that is. And Sue's mentioned to me this morning. She said, "How long do you think Fahrenheit's been around?" I said, "I don't know. It's been around like 20 years. I think it was 75."
You're still a Fahrenheit guy.
1975, some days.
Yeah, I'm still a Fahrenheit guy. And one thing I can't understand, considering that the metric system has been in Canada for...
75.
All right, since 1975. How is it that there is nobody, I don't think there's a single person in this country that when you're talking about the height of someone says how tall they are in meters. You may say that you may understand kilometers as far as how to drive. You may understand the temperature in Celsius. You may understand weight in kilograms. There is not a single person I have ever met when you say, "How tall are you?" They go, "I'm 1 meter, 14 centimeters." Never. It's only ever been in Imperial when it comes to height, and I don't understand it.
And it's all, and weight too.
Generally, there are some people who know, there are some people who would say it in kilograms.
I'd like to figure out what I am in kilograms. Got to sound a lot better than pounds.
Well, you might be measured in stone.
Tones.
But no, I've literally never, other nope. than at the Olympics, because the Olympics do everything in metrics, so you'll see on the things on the screen, yeah. It says he's 1 meter, 47 centimeters, and I'm looking at that going, wait a sec, does that mean he's a little person or is he a giant? I can't tell. What's that? It means nothing to me.
When you go to a par 3 at Copetown Woods, it doesn't say it's 136 meters.
No, that's true. Yards, you're right.
And when you go to the football game, it's still 10 yards. It's not 10 meters.
Yes, although that's true, but I do think that a lot of people, maybe the majority of people now, at least understand what a meter is. If you said it's 15 meters, they'd have a pretty good idea what that is.
Yeah.
Again, with height, as soon as you turn it from horizontal, from length to vertical, it's like, I got no idea now. I got no idea now how tall you are.
Well, you're probably about 2 meters high.
I may be. But I couldn't tell you if that's probably close.
That'd be 6'6". No, you're not probably.
Well, no, getting close. But it's just a weird one. That is the one thing that has never, even in schools, like you would think that all the kids who came up who've only ever known metric.
Since 75.
Yeah. So that's basically that's half the population.
Decades. That's generations.
Yeah. That's probably more than half the population. Yep. And again, have you ever heard anyone?
Never.
So on your teams, you have some guys that are older, but you have some guys in their 20s. Yep. So they would have been in that category who have only ever been in the metric system. And you say, when they call on the phone, you go, "Hey, what are we putting down here for height and weight?" Has anyone ever said, "I'm 1 meter, 42? I bet not.
I probably just hang up and say, "Son, you should move along here."
Yeah, there's a senior team for you in Sweden. Yeah.
Well, all of our players would have.
A what?
All of our players would have learned the metric system.
Yeah, you're right.
All of them.
Yeah, it's such a weird one that has never caught on. That's never become a thing. I think
south of the borders had some influence. It was
sure it has.
Begrudging.
Sure it has.
People that got dragged along. On my phone, I flipped it over to Fahrenheit about 6 months ago, and I hadn't. I know. 21 is a beautiful day. I know 30 is...
16 is 61. That was the first one I ever learned because you just flip it around. So, yeah. And then you work it from there.
So 20 is nice out. you know, zero is cold. And after that, doesn't matter. Still cold. You got to wear a big coat.
But even when you say south of the border has had an impact, I agreed. But even the fact that we have the Indy 500 as opposed to the Indy 743.2 or whatever, I mean, we don't do that. But again, I think people here understand what 10K is.
So, okay. So the Americans.
They know both.
Americans are imperial.
Yeah. But they would, no American would come up here and go, what's 10K? Very few would know what a 10K run is.
But they don't have the 100-yard dash.
Nope. No, because that's an Olympic
sport.
They
don't have a 200-yard dash.
Because internationally, track and field is all done metric.
They like to flex their muscles. They don't win on that one.
Well, you can say it all you want, but you can have all your guys, you can have Carl Lewis, that's dating myself, but whoever, you can have them training for the 100 yards. That's fine. As soon as they let up at 100 yards, the other guys blow past them for the next few meters and they lose. So there's no sense. Anyway, it's a weird one. It is a weird one. But back to the Blue Jays, which I don't know how we ended up there. And you know what? Yeah, we do say it's 60 feet, 6 inches. I don't know how many meters that is. We don't say the pitching mound is 14 meters away from home plate.
But it's an American game, I guess.
It's an American game. But I do get a little more romantic about the beginning of the season than I do. I mean, but I do it for the Leafs or for NHL. I love when the Leafs have the, who do they have? The bagpipe, the Highlanders, whatever they're called. Pardon me for
51st Highlanders.
Yeah. I love having when they come on, the great tradition for opening out of the Leafs. And I'm most impressed that in all the years that I've ever watched the opening game for the Leafs, not one bagpiper has ever slipped on the ice.
Were you going to see if a Dundas pipe and drum fall? We're having them at
the— You're going to have them?
Yep, open ceremonies Monday night.
Excellent. Well, I hope I just didn't jinx something, but never once have I seen one of them take a tumble, which is amazing. I love that tradition, though. You know, NFL, CFL don't have that same feeling. They don't really treat it like baseball or hockey do, seemingly. I like that.
No, it is always a big deal, opening day. I mean, in every ballpark, and everybody talks about the home opener, and they got beautiful weather today. I mean, that's a bonus when it's in the 70s or it's in the 20s. Sorry.
And you're right that it's just one game. There's 162 games, and yet they make a big deal about the fact that you're going to be the opening day pitcher. I mean, you're going to have 37, if you're healthy, 36, 37, 38 starts in a year, and somehow being the opening day starter.
Well, you're crowned number one on the rotation for the most part.
Yeah, sure, and I get why it's a big deal. It's just a funny thing that it's so big. I love it. I love that part of it, that it is, you don't have— that's one thing that's missing in, say, hockey. You don't— I mean, well, hockey has starting lineups.
Being the starting goaler and opening night for the Leafs is a big deal.
Yeah, but you're not always starting your best guy because you could have a back-to-back and the next team, you know, you're lining it up. In hockey, the starting lineup doesn't necessarily mean anything because you're on the ice potentially for 30 seconds, then you're off. Like, it's not like it— in basketball, when you're playing potentially the entire game, it means something. To say you're starting at center for the opening game of the Leafs season, what does that mean? Has anyone ever remembered could anyone right now say with absolute certainty they know who was in the starting lineup for the Leafs on opening day this year? I mean, you might say it was Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner, but would you bet money on that? I wouldn't. I have no idea. They might have started their checking line.
Yeah,
I just like the romance of baseball. I like that it's a big deal about who starts. They make a big deal about being there. It's a big crowd always. Of course, there's 18 people there in the crowd the next day. But
in June, when we review this, I'm going to ask you who the starting lineup was.
For the Jays?
Yeah.
I'm not going to remember who the starting lineup was, but I'll remember who the starting pitcher was because he was the opening day at home.
Who is it?
Well, it's Manoah. Alek Manoah. And it lined up great for him because he was the
he got both
opening day and home opener. That's a double whammy you rarely get.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, good for him. But no, I do. I find it. There are certain things in sports that you can romanticize. You just talked about the Masters. We're going to come back after the break and talk about that. The Masters, you can romanticize. Opening day of the baseball season, you can romanticize. There's just not a ton of things that still have that, to me, that feeling that it's more than a game. And I don't just mean bigger, like a championship. It's just an event.
Let's hope Manoah's got a 120-kilometer fastball tonight.
Yeah, he's Sid Finch. Do you know who Sid Finch is?
Oh.
Sid Finch was a character written on April 1st back in about 1986 by George Plimpton, the author who wrote the Paper Tiger and Paper Lion.
Yeah,
and did a bunch of others. And he wrote it for Sports Illustrated about this Buddhist monk-like pitcher that was found in the in the Alps or in the, where was he? I can't remember. And he threw the ball 160 miles an hour and his delivery was, and it put no strain on him. And he had to wear one work boot on his one foot to balance him. And it was one of the greatest, you can find it online. The Curious Case of Sid Finch. It's one of the great sports stories ever written. And few people caught that it was on the April 1st edition. And if you read the first letter of, so The Curious Case of Sid Finch, and then there's the subhead, like the longer headline. If you read the first letter, it says Happy April Fool's Day of each word. But it was one of the great stories. He was from Tibet. He played the French horn in his free time. And one of the great descriptive parts was he was signed by the Mets unseen, because one of their scouts had seen this guy, and they put up winterized fencing around their bullpen area so nobody could see him. And all you kept hearing was the ball slamming into the catcher's mitt and then the catcher whimpering. Look it up. This Curious Case of Sid Finch. It is one of the great stories, fictional, I think, stories ever written. I read it. I didn't catch it. I thought, this is weird. I remember when I had a Sports Illustrated subscription. This is weird, but wow. And because of his delivery that put no strain on his arm, he could pitch every day. The Mets were going to be unbeatable that year. All the other pitchers were concerned for their futures because he could throw 180 pitches a day and throw every single day. It was a great story.
Save him a lot of money, too.
Save him a lot. Well, until he gets time to sign him to a new contract. $1 trillion for Sid Finch. Don, you had mentioned the Masters that was on last weekend. I love the Masters. It's a great place to be. It's a great tournament. I rarely have a rooting interest, though. I mean, I'd like Mackenzie Hughes to do well, local guy, of course, and he did well. But I rarely have a rooting interest. I actually found myself this time actively rooting against any of the guys on the LIV Tour, which I found very surprising that I cared. But somehow leaving the PGA Tour and taking money from the Saudi government to play golf, this was my chance, it seems, to really hate on them, and I kind of found myself doing that.
Can you imagine if Koepka, is how you say?
Yeah, or Mickelson.
Well, hang on. If Koepka had won it and Mickelson was second.
Yeah. Well, Mickelson could have won this thing because Koepka fell off. Mickelson came on and had shot a 65 in the final round. And, you know, Greg Norman is the villain of the LIV Tour. There's no question. He's not even playing now, but he's the spokesman.
He also blew the biggest lead in Masters.
I know. But he is the villain here. He's not playing, though. I would suggest that number two on the villain list is Patrick Reed, because just everybody hates Patrick Reed. Apparently he did very well, but number three would be Phil Mickelson, I would think.
It's hard to cheer against him.
I think he turned some people back around to his side this weekend who were really hating on him for what he did, but suddenly are like, oh, well, okay, he's not that bad.
And here's what's interesting, and I found myself in a similar circumstance as you. I wanted Ron to win. But if you think back, like Mickelson's, what, 51?
Two, yeah.
52. Signed for, I don't know, what do you get, $100 million signing bonus. I'm so much of a traditionalist. I look at guys like him and say, why did you do that? Like, you can't possibly need the money. Dustin Johnson can't possibly need the money. Although Dustin Johnson's guaranteed he set up his family to be rich for a long, long time. But as a traditionalist, you kind of go, I don't know. You know, if young guys like Corey Connors and Mack Hughes and somebody offered them $25 million and their career winnings are under $20 million right now and said, we'll give you $25 to sign and you can win another $20, then you go, well, that's a business decision. But with guys, you know, some of the guys that went that didn't need to go.
But see, that's the thing, Don, is that the guys who got all the big money, it's you're right, I suppose. Although if I've won $20 million in my career, I like to think that unless I'm terrible at managing money, I can probably make myself, I can invest that and make it last. But the guys who got all the big, big money are guys who have already made big, big money. And I couldn't help but every time I heard of, oh, Mickelson got $150 million or whatever else, so they were offering Tiger Woods $300 million. He didn't take it. I just kept thinking of that line by Rockefeller when they asked him how much is enough, and he goes, just a little bit more. If you've already made $200 million playing golf, do you need, I mean, you're right. You've in some cases destroyed your reputation. You've destroyed your legacy. You've become disliked. You've probably got no sponsorships anymore. Your place in golf history is tainted, I would suggest, for most of them, so that you, a guy who has $100 million already can have another $50 million. What are you going to do with the first 100? You couldn't go through that if you tried.
I know, as you do, a number of very successful business people, and Rockefeller's right. I mean,
sure,
these guys are independently wealthy now. They're doing very well. They don't need to work again, but they still work. And they're still looking for that deal, and they want the edge in the deal, and they want to make a little bit more money. And they don't need to work. They don't need the deal, but it's what's inside of them. And from that aspect, it's a business decision.
But isn't it, okay.
In golf, it's different because if you want to talk about a legacy, and, you know, if you're looking at it, like some of them looked at it and said, you know, people don't like me, I'll just buy my own legacy.
But if you're a businessman, you're a businessman. If you're a businessman and you're competitive, you may look and the currency, literally and figuratively, the currency that determines who is doing well in business is money. That is, that you know, no one, there's no constant between buildings. Oh, I own 12 buildings, you own only 5. Yeah, but my 5 could be bigger than your 12. Like money is, if you're using business as a competitive vehicle, money is the thing that determines who's ahead. In golf, you don't, you have actual golf to determine who's ahead. So if you've already got 15, 20, $30 million, whatever it is, again, I just, I find it hard to believe that these guys wouldn't have said, I am set for this lifetime and 3 after this. And if I invest it, my family for the next 5 generations is going to be okay. I don't know that I need another 50 and ruin everything.
Well, obviously, they don't think they've ruined everything.
They clearly don't. But are they wrong or are they right?
Well, here's the part that gets makes your brain work a little bit. Is Mickelson and Koepka still played in the Masters?
Yes.
And if they can still participate in those kind of things, and it would be interesting to talk to somebody on the inside to see if they truly were treated any differently than the rest of the guys. Mickelson apparently was unusually quiet all weekend. And
didn't even do interviews, apparently. The TV never asked him to come on, which is amazing. Like, it's clear that CBS, perhaps, and the Golf Channel, I don't think he did any interviews on TV, and I don't think, and I read somewhere that that was not by choice.
He didn't turn any down.
I think that the TV networks have said, blackballing you essentially. We're going to show your shots because we have to, especially.
And
if
they talked about him. They talked about how well he played on Sunday.
Sure, they did. But we're not going to give you, if we're broadcasting PGA Tour events, we're not giving you more than that.
That's probably pretty wise on CBS's. They're partners with this, the PGA. I mean, yeah. Media. I mean, there's a reason they call you media partners.
Yeah, and look. As we're sitting here talking, no one has walked up to me and said, I'd like to pay you $50 million to come and switch to a different radio station or a different paper. I would never leave 900 CHML. But no one's ever offered me $50 million to do it. I acknowledge that it would be an interesting discussion to have with your family and within yourself if that happened. I get that. I'm not naive to the fact that we're talking here with no real skin in the game or money on the table. I get that. It's easy to talk about it when it's not a real thing.
If somebody offers you $50 million to leave CHML and you're not sure, call me. I can help you through that answer for a nominal commission fee.
But let's go back to the point, though. I am not making millions of dollars a year so that would be just more money. That, to me, that would be life-altering in every conceivable way. For these guys, their lives... I don't know if you watched on Netflix that series on the PGA Tour.
Nope.
I can't remember the name of it now. And Koepka, there was an episode that was filmed partially in his home. Koepka is essentially got everything he could ever want now. So to add another $20 or $30 million, so he buys. And I mean, again, to me, somebody may say you're crazy. Take every dollar you can get out of this. To me, if I'm already comfortable and I've already got what I need, and I can maintain my legacy, and I can play in the best tour, and I can still be considered in those group of the great golfers and all that stuff, I would do that. That's just me.
Here's my assessment, which you didn't ask for.
I did. Absolutely, I did.
Rory has a far better standing in the golf community now for the stance he's taken and the fact that he's annoyed with these guys that went to live. I think he's elevated his stature in the golf world versus the other guys by saying, I made a lot of money, this is the greatest tour in the world, and I'm staying with it. And you never should have left.
And Tiger Woods. I mean, I don't know if the Tiger standing could have been any higher, but he didn't go. And I think the guys and a lot of people respect that.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.